It's earnings prediction day, and Kurt Wagner from Recode and Renee Ritchie from iMore are here to walk us through it. Plus, what you need to know about Beyoncé's Lemonade and why the Samsung Galaxy S7 might not be the best phone for dads. All that and a whole lot more on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1499, recorded Monday, April 25th, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Igloo. Igloo software is an intranet that you will actually like. It connects people with the information they need to do their best work. Try it for free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action.
And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now to take advantage of their Mother's Day limited time sale through May 3rd only, and enter promo code TNT for a free color upgrade.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we like to talk about the tech news.
We like it. Sometimes we love it.
We like to talk about it till you're tired of listening to us talk about it.
Until the next day when you're ready again.
And we hope you are. Yeah. I'm Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. And we, I don't know, it was a long weekend. And this was not a restful weekend. It was like one of those crazy, like, go, go, go weekends. I almost feel like I worked 7 days last week.
Well, I almost feel like I did because I did.
You kind of did, actually. You were on the, that's right, you were on the screensavers.
I hosted the screensavers, which is a great, it's totally a fun show to do.
Yeah.
The producers on that show are way nicer to me than the producers on this show, which is me and you.
Yeah, than you are to me.
I know. They're way nicer to me than I am to you. You're always nice to me. I'm not so nice to myself.
Not true. All right. We're just kind of digging deeper and deeper.
Let's start talking about some news.
All right.
Talk to our guests.
I think we've got some things to talk about today. It's hard to believe that the Apple Watch is 2 days from its one-year birthday. Ask people whether it's been a success or a failure, and everyone is likely to have a different view. Joining us to talk about the wearable 1 year in is Renee Ritchie from iMore. How's it going, Renee?
Oh, awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure getting you on the show. So in your opinion, let's just start off here. Where does the Apple Watch stand in the pantheon of Apple product categories?
Well, it's a brand new category. And if you go back to like when the iPhone was introduced, that took a while. One carrier, one country, very expensive at the beginning. The iPad was originally, you know, very RAM constrained, and it was launched in the U.S. before other countries. And there's always a feeling out process in the first year with the first device, because Apple puts it out there and sort of tests the waters. And then as much as they have an idea about the product, we give them tons of feedback. And then that results in the iPhone 3G or the iPad 2. And it sort of feels like 1 year later, we have some idea about the Apple Watch, but we've already gone from, like, I don't think Apple mentions the communication stuff on the Apple Watch at all anymore. They're sort of focusing in on notifications and health, the things we've told them interest us the most.
It is so funny because that's how they pushed it. You know, you can send your heartbeat. You can draw a picture. You haven't
heard. Because they didn't even know. They didn't know exactly how people were going to use it.
It's weird. Isn't it a little weird, Renee, that they didn't know that? I mean,
It's a weird product category, because usually what Apple does is, you know, the exception, of course, was the Apple II, because they were on the crux of that. But what they usually do is observe a product category. So, for example, there were BlackBerries and Trios and all sorts of smartphones, a lot of stuff from Nokia for years, maybe for a decade before Apple got involved. And tablet PC was a thing for a decade before Apple got involved with that. And they could look at those markets as they were maturing, as they were sort of going from early adopter to mass adoption phase. And they could see what problems they thought existed, and they could figure out how they could solve them, how they could bring value to it. But the wearable was brand new. The gentleman who started some of the early watches is like, we're in Palm 5 stage. We're not even in Trio stage yet. Eric Michkovsky, I'm going to murder his last name. I apologize, Eric. But it was really early in that phase. So Apple is now being part of the experiment instead of having the ability to look back at a decade of wearables and then figure out where they're in it. It was much earlier than they usually enter.
So the first generation Apple Watch sold twice as many units in its first year as the first generation iPhone did in its debut. When the iPhone debuted, you know, that first year was seen as a pretty large success. Why is that perception different now between the two categories?
It really is a perception thing. Like, in fairness to people who are maybe down on the Apple Watch, the iPhone was in one country on one carrier for much of that time. It did go into England and Ireland briefly, but it mostly was an AT&T product, which limited the addressable market, where the iPhone launched in many, many countries and has a very large addressable market, limited only by you have to have an iPhone that supports it. But it's also modern times now. We've sort of seen the adoption of smartphones. We've seen the adoption of tablets. And our expectations are based on everybody having these screens with them all the time. So we don't look at how the iPad started or how the iPhone started. We look at where they are now. And we sort of judge the Apple Watch fairly or unfairly by those metrics.
Well, I think that I love my Apple Watch. I'll just say that. But there's so many things about it that I just look at it and I'm like, why do I love this? There's this promise that is
why
broken.
Why do I love you, Apple Watch?
Why do I love you? I wake up, I put it on my, why do I love you so much? I have no idea. It's like a broken promise every minute. Like I keep pressing that Twitter app on my watch and I'm never going to get to Twitter. If I ever get there, it's going to be so useless to me. And, you know, there's no, and my battery is just ridiculously small. I know it's like I have the smaller version, and I guess, you know, I work out for a long time, that wastes it. It's like getting my heart rate for an hour, so I get it. But yeah, I don't know if was the iPhone like that. Was I don't think they had so many promises that they were breaking every day to people with the
I mean
iPhone.
Like, because someone who was writing about the iPhone when it was launched, and people who had snarky bosses were like, this isn't even a real smartphone, it doesn't run apps, it like I can't go in there and because if you remember Windows Mobile back then, you could it looked like Windows. You could go into network administration and you could run it. It could cost $30 for a sticky notes app, but you could get that sticky notes app, and maybe it would crash your phone every time you ran it, but you could get it. And the iPhone was incredibly impaired, maybe is even the proper word, but it did certain things so well. I call it the minimal delightful product, where it's not the minimal viable product because maybe it doesn't do everything, but there's certain aspects of it that are so delightful that people are willing to put up with it. And that was like the pinch to zoom and the multi-touch with the iPhone. It was such a great demo experience that you're like, oh, you know, I don't care, it has no apps, I'm pinching and zooming my photos, and you know, it made you feel happy. And the Apple Watch has a little bit of that. But for me, I have the bigger watch, and I don't work out anywhere nearly as much as I should or as much as Megan. But for me, it solves really important problems. Like, for me, it solves notifications, and it's like I have Authy on my wrist now. And I don't think that apps is the right model, maybe. I think Apple just assumed, and maybe everybody assumed, that we have apps on our phones and apps on our tablets, so we need to have apps on our watch. And I think maybe within a year or two, especially now, we're seeing the decoupling of apps. We used to have webs, and now we have, like, websites. Now we have web services, and we used to have apps, and now we have features in Share Sheets and in CarPlay and in Action Sheets and in widgets, and all that stuff is being unbundled. And I think we'll have like just little bits of functionality that show up on our wrist that are much lighter than apps, but are there when we need them. So I think we're maybe a generation or two away from that.
Okay, so we've maybe buried the lead to a certain degree here, because part of this story kind of stems from a report in the Wall Street Journal, and they kind of buried the lead too. It was kind of buried inside the article, saying that an upcoming feature would be the inclusion of cellular connectivity inside the Apple Watch, possibly on, you know, the next version or an upcoming version at some point. Is this the kind of feature that's going to turn perception around? Like, I know that at least on the Android Wear side of things, LTE connectivity and a watch, I mean, maybe some people are asking for that. And I think some people who don't understand why they need a smartwatch might be asking for it just out of like a knee-jerk reaction of why does it have to be tied to a phone? But the realities of doing that come with some serious downsides, primarily, at least on Android's side, battery. Like, that's a tiny little device with, you know, with a battery that's working as hard as it can. Now you add in mobile connectivity and you're not going to get as good battery life out of it. And that's why you tether. I mean, is this the kind of thing that's going to turn perception around on the Apple Watch in a future version?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things that work there. And absolutely, the currency of any mobile device is battery life. Every feature you add, you pay for in terms of battery life. The existing iPhone runs pretty much at the thermal limits of that device. It has an Apple S1 computer on a chip, and it is running flat out. You can't really do much more. And there'll be a second generation S2 and an S3. And, I have friends who have some of those watches with LTE, and they're really big, and they're not great on battery life, almost like, you know, the original Thunderbolt was as an LTE phone. We go through these cycles. Are people looking for that? It's hard to say. Some people are like, I have to have GPS, and other people are, I have to have 2-day battery life, and other people are, I have to have LTE. And the more GPS and LTE you add, the less battery life you have. Mm-hmm. So it really is a bartering system. You have to figure out what is the most important feature to the most people, and then you sort of strategically stage that out. And Apple's been really slow. Like, the first iPhone didn't have 3G, and it took them, I think, until the iPhone So the 5.5 to get LTE. And they've always been very conservative when it came to power management. And that's probably going to continue. But when the watch is a standalone thing, when it no longer has to be forcibly coupled with an iPhone, you do, again, people can just go buy. If that's all the computer they need, they can just go buy a watch. And that fits with Apple's philosophy. Because, like, you know, the philosophy Phil Schiller stated is that every product underneath has to put pressure. Like, they want to make an Apple Watch that's so good it makes people doubt whether they need an iPhone or not. And then it's the iPhone team's job to make an iPhone so good you doubt whether you need an iPad, and then so on to the Mac. So their absolute goal with that product is to make an Apple Watch so good you'd almost never have to run back to your iPhone. And then the iPhone sort of has to fight for its right to survive after that.
I think you make a really good point about having, you know, which features to choose, because, and maybe it comes down to these devices are so small and they're so personal that we get this idea that, like, I want it to do exactly what I want it to do. I want GPS so I don't have to attach my phone when I'm running. You know, I want to be able to respond to emails while I'm in the shower. Like, I have very specific use cases for watch.
I could do that with, like, a to-do list, because that's when I think of all the things I need to do that day is when I'm showering. Anyway.
Yeah. So those are my very specific needs. But yeah, yeah. I mean, maybe I'm just expecting too much. So speaking of expectations, Apple is going to announce earnings tomorrow. What are the analysts predicting, Renee?
I mean, doom, as usual. The Wall Street is an interesting thing in that Wall Street is mostly driven by speculation, and it is very largely detached from reality. And you sort of have Apple and any public company has to negotiate that, and they have to manage it. It's almost like human engineering or social engineering, and that they're very carefully crafting messages and trying to present things in a way that makes Wall Street as happy as possible. And that's traditionally been really hard for Apple. So the problem that Apple faces is that they had incredible acceleration with products like the iPad. If the speed limit's 100 miles an hour, Apple got from 0 to 100 in like 2 seconds, and then they're at maximum speed. And then everything after that, because Wall Street looks at acceleration, not speed, they're like, you weren't selling as many as you were before. And, you know, the iPhone, if everybody on Earth bought an iPhone, it would have zero growth and Wall Street would panic. It wouldn't be, yay, everybody on Earth bought an iPhone. It's like, who do you sell it to now? We better get Mars online. So, I mean, like, it absolutely is what it is, but we sort of have to understand what that is before we put too much stress on it.
And what about services, Apple's services? They're becoming a bigger deal. What role do they play in their bottom line?
So that's part of the social engineering that I was mentioning. That's Apple trying to create a narrative for Wall Street, because Apple as a device sales company has sort of never worked for Wall Street. There are companies that have almost no profit, that have valuations far or price earnings ratios far in excess of Apple, because Wall Street's like, any day now, they're going to turn on that profit any day now. When you're already making a lot of profit, it takes so much more to move that needle. So services is a way to sort of retell Apple's story and not say it's about iPhones, total iPhone sold or total iPad sold, but about the amount of money every customer brings in. And as you add things like iCloud, Apple Music, the Apple upgrade program, then people who are spending money on Apple, if they have 1 billion users, for example, it's not just buying an iPhone, but it's all the subscription services they add onto it. And that is sometimes a much easier story to understand, but it remains to be seen whether Apple can convincingly sell it or not.
Well, Renee, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. Renee Ritchie is from iMore. You can hear him tomorrow on the MacBreak Weekly podcast on Twit and the iMore podcast, which launches over the weekend, which is a great podcast. Thank you so much, Renee.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
Take care, Renee.
Bye-bye.
All right. Remember that thing called choice?
I remember that?
Oh, that distant memory. In the cable industry, that thing just got a bit smaller as the U.S. Department of Justice, along with the Federal Communications Commission, approved Charter Communications' acquisition of Time Warner Cable, along with Bright House Networks, all three of them together, paving the way for it to become the second largest cable TV and ISP in the U.S. The deal has attached to it conditions that are meant to keep this giant behemoth from stamping out the rising success of online video. 7-year conditions, basically, that prohibit data caps and usage-based pricing, interconnection fees for heavy traffic providers. Those, you can imagine, you know, providers like Netflix and, you know, video services that just consume data like crazy, as well as making exclusivity deals that might damage online video providers. So they set these terms for 7 years to kind of, I don't know, allow the, you know, online video market to mature more than it already has, which is good, but My God, I mean, it's like two main providers now, this and Comcast. That's pretty, you know, and in some markets, this basically means that if you had choice between two, you now just have one. And that just doesn't sound like a good idea to me.
It doesn't. It seems, it does seem like we don't have a choice, and we all get so annoyed by it. I mean, you know, we get down to like, it's funny, we don't think about, oh, what if there's no Windows phone, then we're only stuck with Android and iOS. We don't feel that way because we love them, you know, like we're happy with the choice. Like,
we have brand affinity that kind of paints over anything else. Right. We're like, cool with it.
But it's like, I don't like any of them.
I mean, I'm sure there are some people that have brand affinity with Charter or Time Warner Cable. I don't know.
If you're one of those people, email me at megan@twit.tv. I want to talk to the person that loves Comcast or Charter.
Yeah, Comcast, that's a different story. Yeah. But I can only speak about that for personal
experience. Have you ever heard someone say, I just adore my cable company.
I know.
They're amazing.
It's pretty much always attached with some sort of negativity. Now, Tom Wheeler has approved the FCC. He has approved. There are four other FCC commissioners that have to sign off on this, but, you know, it's pretty much a sure thing at this point. So I don't know. But 7 years, it's kind of like, okay, you built these things in 7 years. At least you did that. But I would like to not have caps forever. Mm-hmm. So that would be nice, too. I guess we'll just keep on asking. Yeah. Maybe it'll happen someday.
All right. Well, Twitter also announces earnings tomorrow. Joining us to talk about Twitter's status on Wall Street and a little Facebook and a little Snapchat news is Kurt Wagner from Recode. Welcome, Kurt.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good. So what do you expect from Twitter's earnings tomorrow?
Well, there's a lot to expect. I think what everyone's going to be listening closely for is whether or not Twitter has been growing. I mean, I feel like we've been talking about this for a couple of years now, which I guess we probably have. But last quarter, when they reported earnings in Q4, I guess, was the first time that Twitter had actually shrunk. The number of, you know, monthly active users had gone down, and a lot of people knew that it was getting close to plateauing, but I don't think there were a lot of people prepared for the fact that it was actually shrinking. And so Twitter has since said, hey, don't worry, like, you know, we're going to be back to where we were in Q3 of last year. And, you know, things are going to be headed in the right direction again. This was just a one quarter thing, but we'll find out tomorrow when they report earnings if indeed they've kind of, you know, got back on track. But either way, I mean, even if they're back to where they were in Q3, that's still about 6 months where they haven't really added any new people. So that's definitely a concern for investors and something everyone will be watching pretty closely.
So what role does live streaming play in this? I mean, they were the big, the big guys on the block. They beat Meerkat, but now Facebook is live streaming too. Is it a rising tide raises all boats situation, or are they really falling behind now that Facebook also has live streaming?
Well, I think it could be a rising tide raises all boats kind of thing if they take advantage of that. And what I mean is that, yes, Facebook is getting into live streaming. They're paying celebrities, they're paying media companies to use their live streaming product. So if Twitter wants, I mean, it could take advantage of the fact that all of the big players that are out there are using this type of product right now. And they should come out and they should say, hey, listen, we know that you're using Facebook Live, but here are the benefits of using Periscope as well. I don't know if they're doing that, to be honest. And they often, you know, they kind of talk a lot about Periscope on the earnings call. It seems like they always kind of flick at how it's the future and how it's really aligns with Twitter's live mission about, you know, talking about things as they're happening in real time. Whether or not, you know, they're going to specifically address Facebook tomorrow and the fact that Facebook's really been pushing into this over the last few months, I don't really know. But I think it's an opportunity for Twitter to really kind of take advantage of the fact that the competitor is in the same space as them. So far, we haven't really seen that, but it'd be cool if they were to, for example, come out with a way for people who are broadcasting to actually make money off of live videos, because Facebook hasn't done that yet. And, you know, that's going to be where a lot of the people pay attention to. If you can make money broadcasting on Periscope over Facebook, I think that's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, no kidding. I fully realize that this is early to kind of make these comparisons, but as I kind of like read about kind of Twitter and its state the past year and just its legacy of, you know, there are a lot of people that use Twitter, obviously, and it's a big brand and there's a lot of like celebrities. So there's much attention to Twitter because of that, because, you know, people who aren't necessarily celebrities have some sort of direct, you know, contact and communication with them, that sort of stuff. So I realize that it's early to make the comparison to Yahoo, but I can't help but like wonder if Twitter is more interested in actually reviving its business and going it alone, or whether they want to be acquired at this point. Is that the less messy scenario at this point, or do you think they have hope to turn it around themselves?
Well, you know, there's two things. When they brought Jack Dorsey in as CEO, I guess it was permanent in October of last year. You know, that was to me a signal like, hey, they want to figure this out. They want to, you know, if they're going to bring someone like that, a founder, a well-known founder, and bring him back to run things, that, you know, to me was like, hey, let's go ahead and try and make this work. I think, you know, you could find someone who could say, well, when you bring Jack in, you're also, you know, dangling a pretty big carrot for an acquirer to come in and say, hey, we want to buy Twitter now that we know it's in good hands, or that's how people thought. Not a lot has changed since then. And I feel like a lot of the chatter, you know, there was a lot of talk about like Google wanting to buy Twitter, even Facebook coming in to buy Twitter. I just don't know who really wants to take that on at the moment, right? I mean, until they kind of show like, hey, listen, you know, we're not losing users and, you know, we can figure out how to make live streaming an actual business and not just a kind of a cool fad that a lot of people are talking about. I'm not sure if anyone's willing to pony up what you'd have to pay for Twitter. I think the market cap is like maybe $15 billion, but, you know, of course, if you're going to acquire it, you're going to have to probably come in significantly higher than that. And that's a lot of money. Like there are only a small handful of tech companies that could probably even afford that, and even fewer who would, you know, kind of have a fit for Twitter. At this point, it seems like they got to do it on their own. But, you know, who knows? I mean, that company, we've been talking about a possible Twitter acquisition for years as well. So you never really know with them. My gut tells me they want to try and figure it out on their own, though.
So those of us who've had to report abusive or violent tweets, it's just been a Herculean experience. Like, it's a lot of cutting and pasting, and it's just like, how do you not get this? This person keeps opening these new accounts. It's hard, and sometimes you just sort of like, you give up because it's so hard. But today, Twitter saying that in the blog post that now you can report multiple tweets in a single report. This is sort of a baby step, as The Verge says. What do you think? I mean, is this as big a problem as it used to be, I guess, abuse on Twitter? And is it something that they're fixing because Wall Street is looking at that? Or is it something they're just doing out of the goodness of their hearts?
Oh, gosh, I don't know if it's out of the goodness of their hearts so much as, you know, when you have users who are having an awful experience, you should fix that because they're not going to come back, and that's only going to kind of permeate to other parts of the service. So I don't necessarily think it's that, you know, they want to be super righteous that they're coming to fix this. I think there are business incentives to do so. But at the same time, I think, you know, it's hard to say whether or not this is still as big of an issue. I feel like you don't necessarily hear about it just as often as maybe you did a year ago. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily mean much, right? I mean, like, we've been talking about it for so long that maybe it's just kind of you become numb to the idea that people bully and harass each other on Twitter. I think what this update does is, like you said, if it's going to make it streamlined for people who are saying, hey, listen, instead of creating six different reports for the fact that, you know, this user has been harassing me six different times, I can make one report and send all the info at one time. I mean, that makes total sense, right? You would think they would have done this maybe 6 months or a year ago. So I'm hesitant to say it's not an issue because it's not an issue to me, but that doesn't mean that it's not an issue to a lot of other people. And, you know, I think that there's a reason Twitter's still trying to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and then you also delve into the free speech aspect, too. I mean, when you start blocking everyone and, you know, really trying to please everyone and create an environment where everyone feels totally comfortable and no one ever says anything that's not nice, like, no one wants that either. And, you know, that's not the way our society works. So, yeah, it's a complicated issue. So it's nice that they're making it easier.
I think. Now, shifting onto Facebook and basically their pursuit of the ever elusive ephemeral messaging market, something, by the way, that Snapchat has captured in spades. Rumor has it that Facebook is developing an app to compete against Snapchat. What are we hearing about this exactly, Kurt?
Yeah, so there was a report in the Wall Street Journal today that Facebook's building an app that I believe opens up to the camera first. So anyone who's used Snapchat knows that when you open the app, first thing you see is the camera. It makes it super easy to take a photo or a video and immediately send it off to your friends. When you open Facebook, you're greeted with the all-powerful news feed where you can scroll through and see all kinds of different things your friends have already posted, but it's not nearly as convenient to actually create stuff yourself. So what the report sounds like, and we haven't, you know, necessarily confirmed that they're making this app, but they very well could be testing something like this. They test products all the time that never show up, or those that, you know, take years to come to fruition. But what this sounds like is definitely an attempt to get people sharing more, right? If the first thing you're greeted with is the share screen, essentially the take photos and share them with your friends push, then of course you're probably going to do that. And I think all of this, you know, kind of ties nicely in with a story that was in The Information. I want to say it was maybe 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. about this idea that organic sharing on Facebook is going down. So that means people actually updating about their lives and their you know, the holidays and their vacations, that's actually decreasing. That was what The Information reported. So the idea that Facebook would be looking for ways to kind of revamp that makes a lot of sense. And certainly replicating what seems to be working at Snapchat sounds like a pretty good idea. So I wouldn't be surprised if this is something that they're actually exploring at the moment.
What I wonder with Facebook when it comes to this kind of stuff, like they've had marginal success on the breakout app kind of strategy. Well, I mean, when you consider Messenger, bad. Messenger has done great. That's like about the only one that they've broken out and has done great. And, you know, these other things that have failed, you know, Poke, Slingshot, Rooms, Rift, all these apps that they've broken out that they've eventually shuttered because it just didn't quite work. It makes me wonder if most of Facebook's users with services like this or apps like this that kind of cater to the Facebook user. Messenger's a little different. It's messaging versus like updating your feed or whatever. Why not just kind of make Facebook easier to share with this feature instead of like taxing, you know, most of their user base with yet another app to launch into this? I mean, it sounds like a good idea from the business perspective to have an app that opens right up to sharing. But I think from a user perspective, that's just kind of confusing. I don't know. What do you guys
think? And it might be the kind of thing where they're working on something like this just to simply test, you know, right. Will people share more, right? And eventually, if they find out yes or no, maybe they take this concept and they do build it into the core app. Because I think you're right, they haven't really been able to develop a hit internally. And I kind of have a theory as to why. I mean, if you talk to any app creators, they'll tell you that the beginning, you know, the 6 months, the 12 months after they launch are incredibly important because they have to iterate so much based on user feedback, right? They only have a small number of users. They're monitoring exactly how they're using it, and they're adapting along the way. I think what Facebook does is it kind of artificially creates this idea that the app is super popular right when it first launches because we all write about it. Everyone rushes to the app store and downloads it. And immediately they have a million users instead of 1,000 users. And it's harder for them to necessarily, you know, tweak it the way that maybe an app developer would who's kind of growing their business organically. I've heard that both Google and Facebook struggle with this, right? They don't get a realistic feedback cycle that the way other app developers do. And as a result, you know, it's harder for them to actually build and launch apps at this point because they have so many users. It seems counterintuitive. But I thought it was an interesting theory. I don't know if that's actually what's happening. I could certainly see it happening. But yeah, you're right. I mean, Facebook has yet to kind of figure out how to build something else internally. You know, they've had most of their success by acquiring other mm-hmm. companies that were already doing well. So,
yeah. Well, Kurt, always a pleasure getting you on the show. Thanks so much for hopping on today and talking about a couple of kind of the big social stories of today. Recode.net, and where can people find you on Twitter?
Yep, I'm at KurtWagner8 on Twitter. And thanks for having me. Appreciate
Absolutely. It, always Take a pleasure, care. Kurt. Take care.
All right. See ya.
Well, after the break, we will get a fix of all our online streaming news with Winter Mitchell from Pop Rocket. But first, let's take a minute to thank Igloo, the sponsor of this episode. Igloo is an intranet that you'll actually like. It's a cloud platform that helps you share files, collaborate on documents, blog updates, coordinate calendars, and manage projects. Anyone can add content based on their permissions with a drag and drop widget and a WYSIWYG editor. Igloo also offers a variety of access, authentication, and identity services to ensure that only authorized users have access in private clouds, over SSL, and with 256-bit encryption. Unlike other solutions, you can customize Igloo to fit your needs and work with your current IT investments. So things like Office 365 or Salesforce, SharePoint, Active Directory, and file sharing solutions like Google Drive, and Dropbox. You can even add Zendesk to keep track of or add new support tickets. It's used by large enterprises and growing companies like User Testing, BDO, American Family Insurance, and ATP World Tour. Try it free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action. And when you sign up through our link, you can get your own Igloo for up to 10 people absolutely free for as long as you want. That's igloosoftware.com/TWIT, and we thank them for their support. It was a big weekend for online streaming, especially exclusive streaming, first with all the Prince tributes and then with Beyonce's new album and film Lemonade. Joining us to talk about all of this is Winter Mitchell, digital consultant and host of Pop Rocket. Let's start with Prince. Welcome, Winter.
Welcome. Hi, guys. What a interesting week it's been, huh?
Yeah, no kidding.
It has. Yeah, let's start with Prince. I mean, we talked a little bit about this last week when it happened, but just tell us your thoughts about it.
You know, Prince, obviously, I'm 36 years old, and Prince was a core part of my life and upbringing, so his loss weighed, this is going to be pretty controversial, but I think it's hitting me a little bit harder than MJ. The contributions he gave to music were shorter than Michael Jackson, because Michael Jackson was a child singer, but we're talking about a man who can play many instruments, who, graciously gave songs to artists and didn't even feature on them. We're talking about from 1978 all the way until today, he was still creating music, was consistent about his musicianship and his commitment to it. It hurts. It's definitely a difficult one to take.
So his music was on Tidal, and then Beyonce's music is also only on Tidal. So tell us, what are your thoughts about that, about this exclusive music streaming?
You know, if you go back in a time when Apple launched with iTunes, they also had sort of the same exclusivity, and they had obviously their deals that were set up specifically for that platform. So it's not surprising that Tidal would want to sort of go after artists that they can maintain and keep that library on their platform. The issue is, which has always been since practically the beginning of Tidal, is that it was a little bit of an audacious effort, given we've come so far since music has been available online. Also, the price point is not for everybody. Also, we can never forget that really ostentatious showing of having all those artists around a round table pretending like they were going to, solve the war in Syria. It's more of a situation where I'm kind of committed to a few platforms and I like it. I've curated those. So the Spotify's, the Pandora's, you have people that are sort of sitting on opposite sides of those, of that discussion. And then there's the people who just won't leave iTunes. Beyonce giving the exclusivity to Tidal for a weekend now, it's available on iTunes and Amazon now. It's her commitment to her brand, and it's a commitment to her partner, Jay-Z. But I don't think anybody was going to pretend for 2 seconds that she was going to leave this on Tidal, given all the issues it's had in the last, basically since launch. She's not going to segregate her market in that way. You're not going to be able to, as she is Beyonce, but you're not going to be able to get every single person that loves your music to migrate over there. You've got to open it up to the masses.
Do you think if a company like Tidal continues down this path, then I suppose it just kind of sets a precedent that this is a service that does this. I guess I'm answering my own question. I mean, 24 hours feels pretty shallow to me. Like, I get it. You want to get your music out there, and I'm sure for Beyonce, 24 hours was a lot to provide exclusivity to one single service and then open it up to literally everyone, because not many people are on Tidal, let's be honest. But I don't know. Is this a way to make Tidal more relevant than it is?
100%. And listen, that was generous. One day for Beyonce is very generous.
Yeah.
And did I think that she was going to leave it up a little bit longer? No, we don't live in that world anymore where something can be out for a week and it will take our time. We'll move, move slowly. No, we consume content quickly, we binge it, and then we come right back out and we talk about it online. So she gave people 24 hours and gave Tidal that capability, which was, again, generous of her. But let's be realistic. She's got to make money. The music industry is in a very weird space right now, and I think it will continue to be in this space for many years to come. She's not looking for lucrative sales just off top from utilizing these platforms to sell her songs. She's giving you the brand, giving you where she's at currently in her career, and then she's turning around and she's saying, listen, you're going to come to the tour because you're going to want to see how this evolves. You're going to want to buy the merch. You're going to want to do everything else that it takes to consume this iteration of my brand. But here's a little jewel for you to sort of whet your appetite on right now. Mm-hmm. So she's not looking to, Tidal is doing what Tidal is going to do. There's a lot of things that are great about Tidal, and there's a lot of things that just aren't great about Tidal. And realistically, like I said before, she's not looking to make tons of money off of offering it just to these people who subscribe. She's trying to grow the brand, doing what she can and being generous, but she's also looking ahead to tour dates, merch sales, and anything else she decides to profit off from this brand. Musicians are not making money off of music. They're making they're making money off their brand in a cohesive manner.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, there's some people might still be confused by all the lemon right. emojis in their Twitter that just happened and on Facebook. So why don't you explain a little bit about Beyoncé's movie that she launched on HBO over the weekend?
So Beyoncé, you know, when she released Beyoncé, she put out on iTunes exclusively a series of videos and then dropped her album out of nowhere on a Friday night and ruined everybody's plans. She's done the same thing, albeit weird timing. Nobody anticipated that Prince was going to leave us so soon or on a Thursday. But she drops the album simultaneously while she debuts an HBO one-hour movie that is basically a visual version of her album, complete with music videos to sort of accompany the songs. This was a love letter to women in general. If we want to be more specific, it was a love letter to Black women. She is really sort of focusing and fixing her current iteration on how to promote sort of the social causes that she believes in unapologetically. People are going on and on about, you know, this is something that pop artists have never done. But the truth is, pop artists who are legendary have been doing this forever. This is just her opportunity to sort of fixate the conversation on something like Black Lives Matter. She's talking about civil rights, feminism, poetry, anything that you can sort of conjure up that falls into those buckets. She touched on with Lemonade.
Yeah, it's an amazing film, and I enjoyed just everyone's response to it on Twitter, like yours included. Just like the people that I'm speechless.
My Rachel Roy tweet. Goodness. You know, listen, I don't try to wade. I try to be diplomatic, and I really don't try to like wade publicly into these discussions or rumors. But listen, Rachel Roy put it out there. She made a reference about having good hair. There's a lyric in one of Beyoncé's songs about, you know, the Becky with the good hair. I'm just saying that if you put yourself out there, you're kind of asking for it. And that's what the internet allows us to do, is respond. Now, listen, there's a lot of different layers on what Beyoncé is covering besides sort of the overall focus on Black women and celebrating the beauty and our humanity. She's talking about her marriage. She's talking about her father and the relationship she has with him. She covers a lot of layers. But what happens is mainstream media has to stick on it real fast. And the first thing they could latch on was the whole Rachel Roy thing. So you've got Rachel Roy and poor Rachel Ray and anybody else that mentioned lemons on Saturday and Sunday getting murdered by the Beehive. I need the Beehive. Don't come at me. Just calm down.
Wow, I am so lost in this conversation, but I love it. I love it nonetheless.
Right. Well, I was hoping that you would help catch up some people around here. So
exactly.
Thank you.
I had no idea why I was seeing so many lemons all over the place.
If you enjoy conversations like this, Winter's podcast on Pop Rocket on Maximum Fun is amazing. Lots of conversations about this and all kinds of other pop culture topics. What is there anything else you're working on that you want to talk about, Winter?
I got a lot of things in the mix. I'm just started working on a column with an app called 8. So that'll be out in a couple of weeks. I'm working with them. They're a brand new application. You can download it in the App Store. Another one of those, but it's doing something different and it's really for the good. And as always, I'm on Pop Rocket and I'm working on a book and I've got a lot of different things in the hopper. So you can continue to invite me back and you can follow the journey. You can debut my own lemonade.
Okay. You need to pick out, just use a word that has an emoji. That's what we've learned from
yes,
lemonade
it
and peach.
It worked for peach. Yeah, exactly.
Use eggplant parmesan.
Okay.
Work on that.
Yes. Just
find a different emoji. Thank you, Winter.
Eggplant, Megan.
All right. Well, you can follow Winter, of course, at Winter Mitchell on Twitter. Thanks so much.
Thank Bye, you, Winter.
Guys. Take care.
Take care. All right, we have an email to tnt@twit.tv from R.T. Cregan from Brooklyn, New York, who said,
So far, every reviewer of the Galaxy S7 on the internet gets a cracked screen. You have one? I assume he's talking to me because I have one. Leo Laporte has one. Andrew Zarian has just cracked the screen on his Galaxy S7. Even Erica Griffin on YouTube. I always say Griffith with her last name. Sorry, Erica. Unboxed a Galaxy S7 Edge with a cracked camera cover. Could there be a real design flaw? Dun, dun, dun. I'm a big OtterBox fan myself. Keep on newsing. I don't know if it's necessarily a design flaw.
Did yours get fixed?
No, that's still in the works. Oh. But yes, it's going to get replaced, essentially. I bought it with a credit card that has built-in kind of like warranty protection on any purchases. So that's my main tip, is check with if you're going to buy a phone outright, buy it on a credit card that has that kind of stuff built in. Like, this would be my second time replacing a cracked screen thanks to that and hardly having to pay a single dime for it. But I don't know if it's a design flaw as much as it is a design choice. And what I mean by that is that there are certain designs like this one that have, and I think that this is kind of the Achilles heel on this type of design, but have the kind of curved glass edges around right down to the bezel. So instead of the bezel seated, oh, here we go. Sorry, it might be kind of hard to see because it's so far away. But basically, the glass curves around to the bezel that's down below it. On a lot of phones, you have a bezel that appears above the glass. But in the case of this phone, and there are a lot of other phones, see, you can see the reflection up there, how it curved, how the light hits that before it hits the bezel. That means that it's curved outward. So if you drop this, the very first thing that's going to hit the ground is going to be the glass. So I think it's just, it's a design choice because a lot of people like their devices to be glass all around. Mm-hmm. And that just basically means you have to be really darn careful with it. And I don't know if it's any more or any less susceptible to cracks than other glass. I know it cracked pretty easy for me. And yeah, more and more we're starting to hear from people that this is happening to. I think it's just a pretty fragile device. I don't think that it's a conspiracy. I don't think that it's anything more than that.
I think it is. I think they failed to do the proper testing with dads because you were sitting on the floor, crisscross applesauce, and it fell out of your pocket.
Thank you for putting it into terms that my six-year-old understands.
And it fell out of your pocket. So, I mean, anyone knows that dads sit on the floor crisscross applesauce.
It's true. If it can't, often singing songs.
You were singing. You got excited about the wheels on the bus, and it fell off. It fell out of your pocket. So if they would just test with the right markets, then
yeah,
we wouldn't have this problem.
If they would just put this through the crisscross applesauce test, then we could prevent this whole mess entirely.
Maybe it's on a dad phone.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen plenty of phones that do this, and I really like the look of it, but in durability, it's always kind of freaked me out because it just basically means there's literally nothing standing in the way. So if you're an OtterBox fan, RT Cregan, who emailed us, then great. That's a great way to protect. I had a case, and OtterBox is one of the cases that I was considering on order for this. 2 days, it was supposed to deliver in 2 days, and the crack happened. So just be careful. I guess that's the short of it. So there we go. Let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode, and that would be Tracker. Actually, I've got a Tracker right here, this tiny little thing. With advancements in technology, we have smart cars, we have smartphones, we have smart homes. Losing your possessions can make you feel less than smart, and this, the Tracker, makes losing things a thing of the past. I mean, we can track the location of our phones, and that's thanks to like Find My iPhone, Android Device Manager. Why can't we have that kind of convenience and peace of mind with anything? And that's what this is all about. That's the Tracker. It's this coin-sized device that locates misplaced keys and wallets, computers, pets, even whatever you like in seconds. You pair Tracker to your iOS or your Android device, attach it to anything. It has a key loop, or you can attach adhesive to it and stick it to the back of something, and it'll find its precise location just with the tap of a button. It does it. You kind of hear it chirping there. And that'll like send a signal to the device so you can find it. It's really that easy. If you lose your phone, you just press the button on Tracker and your phone rings, even when it's on silent. So it kind of works in the opposite direction. The Tracker Bravo is constructed with just a really nice and anodized aluminum. It's super thin, super durable, and it'll track anything you stick it to. With over 1.5 million devices, Tracker has the largest crowd GPS network in the world. So your lost item actually shows up on a map, even if it's miles away. If an item goes missing, the Tracker app records its last known location on a map. And then if another Tracker user comes within 100-foot range of your lost item, you're going to get a GPS update of where your item actually is. So it's kind of like the crowd, the Tracker user base is helping you find your items, your lost items. Tracker recently introduced Tracker Atlas, which works with your Tracker Bravo or third-party Bluetooth tracker to pinpoint your items on a customizable floor plan of your home. So you'll know that it's under the cushion in the couch. Save time and energy by simply asking Tracker Atlas where your item is, and you'll instantly get the answer, and you don't even need to search for it. Go to thetracker.com and never lose your possessions again. Right now, Tracker is having a Mother's Day limited time sale through May 3rd only. That's May 3rd only with their best prices ever. Plus, just for our audience, if you enter promo code TNT, you'll get a free color upgrade. That's thetracker.com, promo code TNT. Thetracker.com, promo code TNT. And we thank Tracker for their support.
It's an excellent Mother's Day gift.
I know.
I spend a lot of time looking for stuff that my kids leave around.
Yeah. Well, I lose so many things, so it's a good Father's Day gift, too.
Yes. All right. Well, we'll talk about that in June. When is Father's Day?
Okay. Fine. Oh, wait.
Well, you have one. And I have them, too. And, yeah, it's like there's so many things I want to put them on. Last week, I asked you to tell us how you reused your old technology. Alan Blair wrote in about how he uses some old-fashioned iPhones to watch TNT. He writes, my iPhone 3GS uses the download feature and the car mode in the Stitcher app, and my iPhone 5 uses Waze for traffic. It works great. I like the separate screens.
Yeah, I'm wondering what you'd do if you had a third screen. So next time you have to upgrade, I can see the right vent over there has space for another phone. I want to see what you make use of that.
Yeah, excellent. I mean,
do it.
Video,
put it to use.
TV, watching Beyonce.
A Twitter
Go.
Ticker?
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
You can show us how you watch or listen to TNT, record a video, take a picture of yourself or your setup. You can post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, Facebook. Use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT and we will find it.
All right. In a farmer's field inside Chile, a huge crumpled mess of balloon and technology came tumbling down from the sky over the weekend. Google insisted the test flight of the internet balloon, which is a Project Loon balloon, was actually a success. And its landing was controlled so as to avoid collision with anyone or anything. So it landed as designed inside this field, basically. The landing happened some 100 kilometers southeast of Concepcion, Chile. That's a town of 223,000 people. Google clarified that its balloons will be directed to release gas, so it makes a slow descent to Earth once it's ready to be removed from service. And if it begins dropping too fast, that'll result in the deployment of a parachute. So they say it's very safe, although local authorities seem pretty concerned. They sent out kind of like it looks like the CSI team to really get to the heart and enhance the photos and see what they have there.
Yeah, it looks like that scene in E.T., you know, where they all come in and it's like along with the big white tent.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's a success. I don't know. Yeah, I guess so. It falls slowly, so you would know. You wouldn't, you know.
I suppose so.
You wouldn't just be standing there and like in a net.
Yeah. Thankfully, Google did say that they had coordinated with local air traffic control as it was kind of descending. So some people knew, but yet they still looked very confused as far as like what was this alien aircraft doing in the field.
Yeah. It looks like the
Roswell.
Yes. maybe that is a Project Loon balloon from the future, and we just don't know it yet. Google's working on time travel with their Project Loon balloons.
They were delivering internet back in time.
Yes. We need to bring internet to the time before internet-capable devices exist. Let's do it.
I'm sorry. If you name your Project Loon, I'm going to make fun of it.
Okay.
Because it's loon.
Fair enough. All right. That is it. We did it.
We did
survived.
It.
Mm-hmm. Tomorrow's guest will be Nathan Olivares-Giles from the Wall Street Journal. Always look forward to having Nathan on the show. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be a part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. You can leave us a short voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. We got that voicemail that one time. It was so glorious. You can also hit us up on Twitter. We are at TechNewsTodayTV.
You can subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNT and leave reviews wherever reviews can be left.
Sprinkle them about.
Yes.
We love discovering them, mostly.
We love discovering them. Good, bad. We like constructive criticism. It's true. Will take it. Sometimes retweet it if you're not careful. And you can tweet at me at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell on the Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, Anthony Nielsen, and all the folks who help us produce this show every single day, excluding weekends. And thanks for you for just being a great audience and for talking tech with us today. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Bye, everyone.